Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life is songs of grief with the yellow fear and fearless eyes.
Welcome to Court Appointed, two dudes' perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I am just a dude.
Just a dude.
Almost a wet dude today.
Yeah, you were going to go for a walk, and I said, hey, it's raining outside. Are you going to go for a walk? You're like, yeah, I don't mind a little rain. And then you're like, yeah, we're not going for a walk. Never mind.
Yeah, it was just a light drizzle. We thought, oh, that'll feel good in the heat and everything we've been having to feel good in a light drizzle. And then it started pouring, and then it started lightning and thunder. And we said, that's probably not a good idea.
Well, I was wondering if you hadn't looked at the radar, because, I mean, it sometimes you look at the radar and it's like, well, it might rain, it might not. Maybe it'll miss us. No, this is a large swath of rain and lightning and thunder coming across our area.
Well, you know the way the fake news media is. You can't believe these things just because they put it up there.
Right, yeah, sure.
Just because they put this big thunder cloud up there doesn't mean it's really happening. It's just the liberal news media.
Right. Just trying to keep everybody out. At home.
That's right. It's a COVID conspiracy trying to keep us at home so we don't get the chance to infect each other running around maskless.
Yeah. You go ahead and go out there and run around in the rain like an idiot.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you what, they're enforcing it on the college campuses.
Yeah, they are.
You see, we're at the Miami of Ohio. They went to a fraternity house, and here were all these people running around on the front porch they were like citing them for not wearing masks and not social distancing. And they said, the one guy, they asked him, they said, we understand you tested positive for isolated. He said, yeah, but you're not isolated if you're mixing with all the other people in the fraternity. he was isolated to contaminating everybody else there.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just in my room and, you know, the kitchen, the bathroom, the downstairs,
the general assembly room. Yeah.
But I'm not going to the formal room. To the formal room.
I'm not leaving the house. I'm right in here with the other 50 people that live here.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine if you lived in a large communal house like that and you did come down with COVID, it would probably be very hard to isolate.
Oh, you couldn't do it in a fraternity house. Not in the ones I'm familiar with. Yeah. There's no way that works.
No,
you have to get off campus somewhere.
Yeah, my fraternity house, we had the group shower room, too. I mean, like, we didn't even have, like, bathrooms in our own room. And we had, a toilet and a sink in our own room. But then for the showers, was kind of a communal shower. So, I mean, I don't even know how you would do that.
Yeah, ours was all communal. There was not even a sink and a faucet, I don't believe. It was all, you went to all the sinks and bathrooms and showers and everything in the one room out in the hall.
Yeah.
So there'd be no way to do it. But that's one of the things a lot of the universities are struggling with. They don't know what to do. Some of them are renting hotels and putting people there. Others are holding dormitories empty. And if you get tested positive, you move to that dormitory for a quarantine period.
It's not a bad idea.
The plan was just put everybody back in school and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's a plan too, I guess.
Yeah. A plan for failure. Well, somebody could be liable for something like that. And if it was a product, that could be a product liability.
That's a segue.
That's so, a stretch of a segue, huh?
This episode is on products liability, which was your suggestion, I believe, Tommy.
Well, yeah, I don't even know where that came from. I think I was reading something in the paper about product liability, and I thought, have we covered that? And as I reviewed it, I think we've covered parts of it, but not really as a topic in and of itself.
Yes, we're going to do a deep dive into products liability.
That's right. We're going to dig deep.
But not too deep, because you don't want to hit your head when you dive in, because that would be a product liability for the manufacturer of the pool.
That's right. You have to put something on the side that says, do not dive.
So when you're talking about products liability, it is essentially talking about negligence actions, but it's kind of a separate little area of negligence actions that has to do with, you guessed it, products.
Thus the name product liability.
So when you're looking at the history of products liability, what that is the erosion of the doctrine of privity. And do you know what privity is, Tommy?
Well, it sounds like privacy, but I'm assuming it's not privacy.
Well,
I guess it's privity is the ability to use something without fear of getting hurt.
No, not you went in a different direction that was not right.
Oh, okay.
Privity refers to the relationship between two parties that can be recognized by law, like, for example, like contracts or things like that. So if you and I have a contract with each other, then it's said that we have privity of contract. But whereas like if you have a situation arising with someone that you don't have a contract with, then you would not have privity with them. They would just be some third party out there. So for example, if you get in a car accident with somebody, you don't really have any privity with them because you don't have any kind of contract with them.
Right.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. It sounds a little sexual though. I'm not sure I like that term.
Privity?
Yeah.
I think Michael and I
had privity with each other. Ooh. See, doesn't that sound sexual?
Not in the slightest. Maybe you do need to go take a walk in a cold shower.
Yeah.
So it used to be that if you were going to sue somebody for some sort of negligence, you could only do that if you were the party of some sort of transaction together. So the only way you could sue somebody for any kind of product that injured you was if you had some sort of privity with them, like you bought it from them.
Okay.
So before that, before we had this evolution of products liability, there had to be some sort of quasi-contractual or contractual relationship before you could sue them for the breach of that duty. Because, when we're talking about negligence, we go back to the
duty.
The duty element. So
the duty element.
So historically, if a negligent manufacturer sold a product to a retailer and then the retailer sold it to the plaintiff, the manufacturer would have no liability. The cause of action would be against the retailer because there was no remedy for the plaintiff against the manufacturer because there was not that connection there, not that privity which was required.
And then couldn't the retailer then say, look, I didn't make this product. You can't hold me responsible.
Well, I mean, they could, but then they would have in turn to file some sort of lawsuit against the manufacturer themselves because they suffered an injury based on what the product they bought. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, there's a theory of liability there, but the person who was actually physically injured had no cause of action against that manufacturer. Right. And additionally, too, I mean, if there's somebody who is a retailer and they have some sort of desirable economic relationship with a manufacturer, they may not want to sue the manufacturer because that might hurt their business relationship in the future. Mm-hmm. So there's other reasons there why that's just kind of a flawed system.
Okay.
And that was the main trend in 19th century law, and courts started to try to carve out different exceptions to injured plaintiffs to let them figure out some sort of remedy when they sued. And privity of contract began to erode when the manufacturer would conceal some sort of defect or the products were inherently dangerous. So that was kind of the first steps. If they tried to hide a defect in the product they sold, then that would be an exception. And even though there wasn't that direct privity with the manufacturer, you could actually file a lawsuit against the manufacturer because they try to conceal something. Or if it was something like was really dangerous, like guns or poison or something like that, then you might have a cause of action directionally against the manufacturer.
Well, and there's a couple of different ways I understand that works. Is one is the manufacturer made something and they made it, you could claim negligence because they made it and it had a defect in it that caused an injury, or it's just simply the design of it. There was nothing wrong. It was made exactly how it was designed to be made, but it, for whatever reason, it was inherently dangerous and caused an injury because of its design, even though it was made exactly the way it was supposed to be made.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's how it kind of evolved later on. And there's other tests that go along with that too, like some sort of risk benefit analysis, even for dangerous products that can be taken into account. Now, the very first case, when you're talking about products liability in the historical sense, is a case called McPherson v. Buick Motor. And this opinion was delivered by one of the really heavy hitters of American jurisprudence case law, Justice Benjamin Cardoza. And he was a New York judge, and he wrote a lot of really kind of important opinions that you read about quite a bit whenever you're studying the law. He was a pretty prolific writer.
Benjamin Cardoza.
Yeah. And so he even has a law school named after him too, I think. So the plaintiff in this case, Donald C. McPherson, was a stone cutter, which that doesn't really have much to do with the case, but I just like the fact that he was a stone cutter. And he was injured when one of the wooden wheels of his 1909 Buick runabout collapsed. And the defendant, Buick Motor Company, had made the vehicle, but they didn't actually make the wheel. The wheel was made by another company, but only installed by Buick. And it was conceded that the defective wheel could have been discovered upon inspection if they had properly inspected it. Buick denied liability because the plaintiff had purchased the automobile from the dealer. And the wheel manufacturer denied liability because the plaintiff had purchased the automobile from the dealer and not directly from the defendant. And in analyzing this case, there was earlier precedent, earlier case law, and the duty was imposed on defendants by voluntary contract via privity, as in the English case of Winterbottom v. Wright. And this was the rule that was followed before the evolution of the product liability case law. And McPherson, the case we're talking about here, McPherson v. Buick, Justice Cardoza stated that privity cannot be a bar to recovery and said, if the nature of a thing is such that it is reasonably certain to place life and limb in peril when negligently made, it is then a thing of danger. Its nature gives warning of the consequences to be expected. If to the element of danger there is added knowledge that the thing will be used by persons other than the purchaser and used without new tests, then, irrespective of contract, the manufacturer of this thing of danger is under a duty to make it carefully. That is as far as we need to go for the decision of the case. If he is negligent, where danger is to be foreseen, liability will follow. So you can see why he was a very good judge, because obviously he was very, very clear in what he was trying to say.
Yeah, because in my mind, not only was the dealer responsible, but so was Buick as the manufacturer, and the wheel people as the manufacturer of the wheel. They all had a hand in the liability.
Yeah, certainly. And there was kind of, you got to think about when this came out. This was 1916. And at this point, with manufacturing becoming mainstream, there started to be more products that are put out there. Before that, everything was kind of, I guess, not really manufactured in a large scale sense. It was just small items purchased, made almost directly from the person that you would purchase it from.
Yeah. So through the early 1900s to the mid 1900s is when your product liability actually arose.
Yeah. Because before that, you really didn't have a need for that. So this is an example of the law kind of evolving along with how things are made, really.
Well, I also thought it was interesting that the United States was the first one really to start developing product law. Now, the EU also has some product liability, but for the most part, those are the standards for product liability that most other countries don't really follow that.
Well, and that's because the Industrial Revolution really started here, for the most part, when we're starting talking about manufacturing and things being made like that. So it makes sense that the law would change here first, and this would be the forefront of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine you getting too far in Russia with a product liability claim. You don't like it, comrade? That's too bad. You bought it. You own it.
Now, there's some other cases that are kind of interesting in the theory of products liability that we're going to get to. But before that, I believe that there is a pending motion that was submitted 5 days prior to this podcast. So therefore, we were able to take it up on argument.
Wow, that was much more involved than usual, but I think this is where I say we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Well, go ahead. Well, the reason I said that is because whenever you file a motion, it has to be filed usually before it's actually heard, obviously, and you have to give proper notice. So I just kind of went off on my own little stream of consciousness there talking.
Oh, okay. Better you than me. I just said, well, this is the ad this week.
All right. Who is the ad this week, Tommy?
We have with us again this week, BetterHelp.com. That's H-E-L-P, BetterHelp.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals?
You mean besides COVID-19, letting me achieve my goals of getting to go eat out and drink good draft beer?
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, who will probably not think that you not being able to go out to eat and drink good draft beer is probably good.
It's bumming me out.
I'm really bummed out about it.
You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online.
And there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in different areas.
This service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account at any time and send a message to your counselor.
You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you don't ever have to sit in uncomfortable waiting rooms as with traditional therapy.
And today, in this day and time, Zoom sessions or meeting sessions or whatever it is online are the way to go. And BetterHelp was already there. They had already arrived at that.
That's right. And they are committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. You can visit their website and read different testimonials that are posted daily.
Visit BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/court, and join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp, they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states.
Our special offer, just for court-appointed listeners, is 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/court.
You can say that again.
Easy for me to say.
That's right. 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/court.
Mike and Tommy want you to get the help you need today. And it's better help.
Now, another theory of liability is in warranty. And generally, there's two types of warranty. You can have express warranty or implied warranty. And as you might guess, an express warranty is one that is written out, whereas an implied warranty is something that works for, that basically a product works for what it was intended to do. Initially, warranty followed with the same kind of privity limitations, but that has been gradually eroding as well. And their exceptions to the privity requirement also began in the early 20th century and involved generally cases which were made for products for human consumption, like food, beverages, drugs, and also things like cosmetics. And the theory is that the ultimate warranty was going to be passed on to the ultimate consumer, not the person who purchased it, not like the retailer in my example. So it kind of makes sense that, as you're having things which are being produced during the Industrial Revolution and things are being produced in a large scale, that you're not going to have that same connection with the person who actually made it. You're going to purchase it from a retailer. So right. It only makes sense that warranty should go along with the product to the person who uses it, not the person who has it sitting on their shelf to be sold.
That's right, because it doesn't do them any good because they're not going to actually use the product. They're just reselling it. They're just the middleman, kind of like... Right. You know, when you drink beer, you're the middleman between the beer and the urinal.
Now, express warranties are passed along to the general public because they were advertised as such. And one of the more famous cases was the Baxter v. Ford Motor Company. So you see a lot of cases that involve cars and production of cars because that was kind of the first things that were really coming out to the public in this era of evolving law.
Well, not only that, think about the whole car industry, how it evolved when the cars first came out and they went to that assembly line production.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things that went to assembly lines, that they were mass producing cars, and they probably didn't have the strict guidelines in place, safety guidelines with OSHA and manufacturing things and all that. So each car dealer or manufacturer was probably just kind of winging it and doing whatever they thought, but they didn't have really any incentive to really double check everything.
Yeah. Now, the one case I was talking about, Ford had advertised that their windshield was quote unquote shatterproof. So they said they had a shatterproof windshield.
Sounds like the Titanic. It was unsinkable, right?
In 1932, I wonder if anything was shatterproof, but I don't know. Now, Baxter, the plaintiff, and it's not known whether or not he was a stonecutter or not, so we're going to go ahead and assume that he probably was not, because it doesn't say so.
Okay.
He purchased a Model A Ford from the defendant, St. John's Motors, who was a Ford dealer. And they had gotten that from the Ford Motor Company. And he claimed that the representations were made to him by both defendants that the windshield of the automobile was made of non-shatterable glass, which would not break, fly, or shatter. A small rock had hit the windshield and caused it to shatter, and the plaintiff lost his eye. The glass flew up from the windshield and hit him in the face, and he lost his eyesight. Mm-hmm. And he sued, and the trial court ordered judgment for both the defendants. And he appealed and argued that the court erred in allowing defendants to introduce into evidence the written contract of the agency between the defendants. So there was a contract which said there were no warranties. The plaintiff contended the court erred in refusing to admit into evidence certain catalogs and printed material which was furnished by Ford Motor to St. John's for distribution and help with the sales. So they had these advertisements which said it was not shatterable, but then there was a contract which said no warranties.
So, in other words, when he bought the car from the retailer, from the dealer, he's saying he signed something that said the dealer is offering no warranties towards this car working.
Yeah, because after that was what the held at the trial court level. And then on appeal, the court affirmed it because there was a provision in the contract, like you just said, that stated the defendant dealer had made no warranties concerning the car. But Ford Motor Company had printed up those materials that said the windshield was shatterproof. And the lower court refused to allow that into evidence because they said it was obviously outside the contract. And the court held that the evidence was improperly excluded. This is on appeal. And even though there was no privity of contract between the plaintiff and Ford, because the windshield did not possess the qualities that defendant manufacturer had represented, there was going to be liability. So that was reversed, and they ordered a new trial against Ford and St. John's Motor. So that was kind of an important case that came up. Because you can see, when you have the middleman, you're starting to have more middlemen out there. And so that would be a shield of liability. So,
well, not only that, I mean, the whole car dealership is set up so that you have to go through there. Manufacturers of cars cannot sell them direct to the public. They have to go through second party dealers or third party or whatever they're considered.
Yeah.
They have to go through them unless you're Elon Musk. Now, he's the only one that can sell his cars direct.
Why is that?
I don't know. They have been sued. That's something else to look at. They've been sued by other car dealers or car manufacturers because they sell theirs direct. It's some kind of things to, I don't know whether it's because they're supposed to be more environmentally friendly or supposed to give them a better competing because they obviously have more costs involved. Or what, but for some reason, he's allowed to sell his direct, and everybody else has to use a dealer.
Yeah, it seemed to me that I've read something before about that. I think there is some sort of law about car dealers and manufacturers that has to go through independent sellers. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Well, it's just to create jobs within the state. It's so that states get some of the money from cars being sold as opposed to just where they're manufactured. I mean, like if all your cars are manufactured in Detroit, then Michigan is getting all the money from selling cars as opposed to the states getting taxes off of them and stuff. So they set up the whole dealership thing to add in that extra layer so the states can get their cut.
Well, but also, I mean, who's going to drive up to Detroit to go get a car?
Well, they could probably still work out a way to get it to you cheaper than going through dealers.
Yeah, maybe so. They deliver it down here.
Yeah. Yeah, or have distribution points. The manufacturer could just set up distribution points or something. So, but you can't. You have to, by law, go through dealers. Ford can't directly sell you a car. You have to buy it from a Ford dealer.
Right. So now, if we're talking about the history of products liability, we've come to the big heavy hitter case of products liability.
Hmm.
And it involves one of the most iconic American companies. But of course, we've already talked about Ford and Buick. So who do you think is more iconic than Ford or Buick as an American company?
Chevrolet.
I like where you're going with that, but no.
They're as American as apple pie.
They are.
Remember the commercials?
This is
Chrysler?
This might be even more American than apple pie, and it's the Coca-Cola bottling company.
Oh, okay.
So this case is called Escola v. Coca-Cola Bottling, and it's a 1944 case. And the plaintiff, Gladys Escola, she was a waitress in a restaurant, and she was putting away glass bottles of Coca-Cola when one of the bottles spontaneously exploded in her hand. So just blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And she suffered a deep 5-inch cut, which severed blood vessels, nerves, muscles, a thumb, and the palm of her hand. So it was a real serious kind of injury.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a little scratch on a piece of glass. I mean, it literally exploded in her hand. And the top portion of the bottle with the cap remained in her hand, and the lower portion fell to the floor but did not break. So the broken bottle was not produced at the trial, but the pieces had been thrown away by an employee of the restaurant shortly after the accident. Escola, however, described the broken pieces, and a diagram of the bottle was made showing the location of the fracture line where the bottle broke into. One of Coca-Cola's delivery drivers was called as a witness by the plaintiff, and he testified that he had seen other bottles of Coca-Cola in the past explode and had found broken bottles in the warehouse when he took cases out, but did not know what made them blow up. So there was kind mm-hmm. of some other evidence which was there supporting that this bottle just spontaneously blew up. It wasn't like it was dropped or knocked against anything or whatever. It just happened to be in her hand and blew up.
Well, sure. Yeah. They'll blow up if you freeze them, or if you shake them too much, they could have blown up.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case. It just boom. And Escola was represented at trial by a litigator named Melvin Belli, and he was kind of somewhat of a legendary litigator, I guess. And he had said in his autobiography, he didn't really fully comprehend the case when he was trying this case. And but it was a pretty big deal because the jury returned the verdict for the plaintiff, and they followed the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, which we've talked about before.
Yeah, I remember hearing that term.
Do you remember what
res ipsa loquitur? Let the buyer beware.
No, it's Latin, which means the thing speaks for itself.
Oh.
And it's a theory which is used when something happens, but you really can't explain why it happened. But it's obvious that it did happen, and there must have been some sort of negligence for it to happen.
The bottle blew up, therefore it's proof that there was something wrong.
Because bottles generally don't blow up like that.
Right. And we don't want them to blow up. That's a negative thing when they blow up.
So Coca-Cola appealed it, and the first appeal, it was affirmed on judgment of the lower court. And they held that even though the instrument causing the injury was not under the exclusive control of the defendant at the time of the accident, the defendant had control at the time of the alleged negligent act took place, the filling of the defective bottle. So
right.
Even though they didn't have the dominion and control over the bottle when it broke, the fact is that the real problem was when they put the contents under pressure in the bottle. So that's when the negligence occurred.
So they're saying that it was probably already damaged before it was bottled, and so that's what allowed it to blow up.
Yeah, that was one theory, but it really wasn't super important about why it caused the blow up, just the fact that it did. And mm-hmm. it wasn't necessary for the plaintiff to try to show why it blew up, because who knows why, but it did.
Mm-hmm.
And in that appeal, they said that the evidence appears sufficient to support a reasonable inference that the bottle here involved was not damaged by any extraneous force after delivery to the restaurant by the defendant. It follows, therefore, that the bottle was in some manner defective at the time the defendant relinquished control, because sound and properly prepared bottles of carbonated liquids do not ordinarily explode when carefully handled.
Well, I would agree with that reasoning.
Yeah. This was in the California Supreme Court. They said, further, even though the defendant produced evidence to rebut the inference of negligence that arises upon application of the doctrine of res ipsa by discussing its safety testing procedures, Gibson ruled that the question was properly submitted to the jury and did not modify the jury's verdict. So the trial court jury found for the plaintiff. It was appealed to the California Supreme Court, who upheld that. Now, the other interesting thing is there was a concurring opinion by Justice Robert Traynor in the judgment And Justice Traynor said that instead of deciding the case on the grounds of negligence, a rule of strict liability should be imposed on manufacturers whose products cause injury to consumers. And he based his reasoning heavily on early cases, the McPherson case that we talked about against Buick. And he argued that public policy demanded that responsibility be fixed wherever it will most effectively reduce the hazards to life and health inherent in defective products that reach the market. So that's a very strong quote if you think about it, because he's kind of cutting to the chase. If we don't hold the people that make these things accountable, then there's not going to be any reason for them to want to make these things the way they should. He felt that manufacturers were better prepared to handle the cost of injury than individual consumers, and noted that California state law had already applied the rule of strict liability to the makers of foodstuffs that cause illness or injury. And he felt that the majority's reasoning approached a rule of strict liability, even though the decision was based on the doctrine of res ipsa. So He was trying to say that rather than use the res ipsa theory, the fact is, it doesn't matter. If they made it and something happened like that, then they should be strictly liable for it.
I would have to agree with that. Now, let me speculate on something that we had a great unforeseen consequence that arose kind of unrelated out of that ruling.
What's that?
That Coca-Cola ruling. Because these glass bottles were blowing up or had blown up and caused injury, what do all the other manufacturers were also using glass bottles. It's not like it was just Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. All bottling drinks, carbonated beverages were using that. What do you think they did to respond to that so they wouldn't have to pay these lawsuits?
I don't know.
I would say they developed the use of plastics, and now all your bottles are in plastic. Well, now, what's the single most environmental damage going on in our world is plastic bottles.
Well, I don't think plastic bottles are a result of this case, because this case was in 1944, and I remember growing up in the 70s and 80s, we had the glass bottles that everything came in. And I think sure. Probably that really it had to do more with making the glass bottles correctly was the response for it, because they kept making glass bottles.
Well, I know. Well, they wouldn't have done it right away. I mean, you wouldn't have seen them right away, and it also depended on the technology and stuff like that. But, I mean, and things take a while to come to market. So it might have been 20 years from the time someone first said, you know what, we need to convert to plastic bottles. It might have been 20 years before they came up with an acceptable process and development of a plastic bottle to deliver it to the customer.
I think the reason they put them in plastic bottles rather than glass is because it was cheaper. I think it had nothing to do with any kind of liability. That's just my two cents. But I see where you're going, with the reasoning, but I think you're... Respectfully, I think you are wrong, sir.
I don't know. Well, it could be. That might be why we got all these bottles. How many acres of garbage is it floating in the ocean? That's all this plastic floating out there?
Yeah, that's your fake news.
What? That's real news.
So this the Scola v. Coca-Cola, that is a landmark case that all first-year law students read, and that's how you are introduced into products liability.
Well, that'd be easy to remember, Escola v. Coca-Cola.
Yeah,
it rhymes, so yeah.
And I think that really, you know, one of the things Traynor said, that the nature of the modern system of the mass production and distribution of goods made it difficult or impossible for consumers to inspect and verify that the products they were purchasing were safe, or to demonstrate that the manufacturer had been negligent. And that's why strict liability is a more practical standard for things such as this. So I think that makes quite a bit of sense, and I think it you know, it does tend to make manufacturers a bit more accountable for these things.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. You know, along those same lines that you were talking about, one of the big names and the heavy hitters in developing that type theory, when you got to the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there were two American law professors, Fleming James and William Prosser, that were published competing visions for the future of the nascent field of product liability. James acknowledged that traditional negligence and warranty law were an adequate solution for the problems presented by defective products, but argued in 1955 that these issues would be resolved by a modification of warranty law tailored to meet modern needs, while Prosser argued in 1960 that strict liability in tort ought to be declared outright without an illusory contract mask. Ultimately, it was Prosser's view which prevailed. And I've heard of that William Prosser before. I think you've brought him up in some episodes past.
Yeah, Prosser and Keaton, that was the horn book that was really popular. And it was Prosser and Keaton on torts.
That sounds like a comedy duo. And now tonight, Prosser and Keaton on torts.
Well, some of the tort cases actually read like comedy things when you read them, but yeah.
What do you do if your tort gets thrown out? You file a retort. But along that same lines, one of the other landmark cases that came out, when I was reading through product liability, they kept referring to the Greenman ruling. But they didn't really go into it. So I was interested. I was curious. What was the Greenman ruling? So that happened. That case was actually Greenman v. Yuba Power Products. And it was a California torts case in which the Supreme Court of California dealt with the torts regarding product liability and warranty breaches. The primary legal issue of the case was to determine whether a manufacturer is strictly liable in tort when an article he places on the market proves to have a defect that causes injury to a human being. The case was originally heard in a San Diego district court where the verdict was against the manufacturer. The verdict was appealed by the manufacturer to the Supreme Court of California, and it was like this. In 1955, the plaintiff, Mr. William B. Greenman, received a ShopSmith, which is a power tool that can be used as a saw, a drill, and a lathe, as a Christmas gift from his wife in 1957. He purchased the attachments to use the tool as a lathe, and he used the attachment on several occasions with ease. However, on one such occasion, the attachment flew from the machine and hit him in the head, causing severe injuries. Over 10 months later, he presented a written notice to the retailer and manufacturer for a breach of warranties and filed a complaint against both of them for damages on the ground of breaches of warranties and for negligence. Now, of course, their defense was there was nothing negligent in what we did. It just happened. They couldn't help it. That was just what happened. But what they found was as that lathe attachment ran, the natural vibration of the rotation caused the setting screws to loosen. Mm-hmm. And it let that lathe fly off and hit him in the head. And, of course, their argument was, well, he should have checked that regularly to make sure that they didn't come loose. But there was nothing in there that said that because I guess they probably didn't really foresee that happening.
Right.
You know, they didn't really think about it. So, you know, they were saying, well, we designed this properly. There was just a problem there with that. And then they also tried to get him on a timeliness because it was 10 months before he filed this complaint. But they ruled that 10 months, when you consider a personal injury was involved, that he had to have time to recover and stuff like that before they would be able to understand everything that happened.
Yeah.
So that 10 months was a reasonable amount of time, whereas manufacturer tried to argue that he should have made the claim within weeks.
Yeah. And, you know, also too, if you think about it, this kind of goes along with the whole theory that even though he should have checked those, he should have tightened them up before they actually sold this product, they should have tested it extensively and made sure that these things don't loosen up. And if it does in fact loosen up, provide some sort of warning that, hey, over time these loosen up, so make sure you check them. Because as the manufacturer of the goods, they're better suited to do the testing and figure out all the problems with it.
Well, it's like they said, the manufacturer has the money to cover it. An individual doesn't have the money to cover the injury claims and all the other kind of stuff, but a manufacturer would.
Yeah. Well, do you know if he was a stone cutter? That's the real question.
No, he was just a guy that did odd jobs around the house, and his wife bought him this handy-dandy tool there to help him out. But here's the difference in then and today. So can you imagine a guy gets basically a buzzsaw, comes flying off and gashes him in the head, and he's in the hospital for weeks and stuff like that and has all kinds of problems and finally recovers from it? What do you think he'd get today? If they found the product, liable, it'd be probably at least hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars.
What were his long-term injuries?
Well, it didn't really say. It just said that it caused severe injuries from it flying off and hitting him in the head. You know, a lathe is not a lot different from a buzzsaw, you know?
Yeah. It's hard to say. I mean, I think when you try to assess how much a case is worth, you tend to look at the injuries that the person has permanently. You look at their past past medical bills to try to figure out what their future medical bills might be too, and you kind of base it off that.
He got $65,000.
Yeah, I would probably value that case at a bit more than that in present day money.
Yeah, of course, in 1957, that might have been big money in 1957.
That's right.
But I thought that was an interesting case because it showed that it wasn't just, you know, a lot of people think of negligence as being something was made wrong or it fell apart or it broke and it shouldn't have, it had a defect in it. But negligence can also come about just by it following the design, but some type of unforeseen thing happened. And then it's like you said, the res ipsa loca, loco, whatever that is, loco karma, something or another. What was that Ricky Martin song or something?
Living La Vida Loca?
Yeah, there you go. That's what I was trying to come up with. The Living La Vida Loca there that says the fact that this happened with it speaks for itself. That means it was, you know, it had a defect in it.
Well, that's going to bring us to Legal
Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I asked Tommy about different legal terms we talked about, and there's a whole slew of them out here for this episode.
So, way more than my little brain will handle.
So we're going to start off with the one that kicked it all off. What is privity?
Privity is the thing that exists between two people that have a contract. If we have a contract, then we have privity.
Yeah, it's just some sort of relationship between them. And contracts, generally where it arises now, in order to sue somebody for a breach of contract, you actually have to have privity of contract with them for the most part. There's different exceptions to that, like, you know, unintended third party beneficiaries and things such along those lines. But for the most part, privity refers to, in this day and age, about contracts.
But it's not really necessarily a contract as far as sit down and sign a contract, because if you buy a product from a retailer with a implied or written out warranty, you have privity with them on that product.
Yeah, a contract can either be oral or written. It doesn't necessarily have to be written out. So,
right.
Contract's a generic term, which generally means like an understanding between two parties.
So, yeah. Okay.
And it's funny you mentioned warranty, because that's my next question. What are the different types of warranties?
Well, there's a written warranty, which means it states, you know, like 10 years and 100,000 miles bumper to bumper, something like that, that would cover it. Or there's an implied warranty. That means, you know, like when you get, if you got a glass bottle of Coke, it was implied that the glass bottle wouldn't blow up in your hand.
Yeah, and both these are actually covered in the UCC now, which is the Uniform Commercial Code, which talks about the sale of goods in the stream of commerce. And so these are kind of codified now at this point. But when you're talking about implied warranty, it's a contract law term for certain assurances that are presumed to be made in the sale of products or real property due to the circumstances of the sale. The assurances can be characterized as warranties, irrespective whether the seller has expressly promised them orally or in writing. They include an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, an implied warranty of merchantability for products, an implied warranty of workmanlike quality for services, and implied warranty of habitability for a home. So there's different kinds of implied warranties if you start breaking them down as to what they are. And whereas an express warranty is created when the seller makes a guarantee to the buyer, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in writing, but they make a guarantee to the buyer that there's certain qualities that the product has. The statement regarding the product or service must be made to the buyer, and the statement must play a role in the buyer's decision to purchase the product or service. And if, after purchase, the buyer feels that the given statement was a misrepresentation of the actual product or service, the buyer can file for a breach of express warranty. So, you know, there has to be something stated about what it does, and then you have to rely on that when you're using that to make your decision to purchase it too.
All right.
So, the next to last one is res ipsa loquitur. What does that mean?
That means the action speaks for itself. That the fact that this thing broke and it wasn't supposed to break, then that means that you were negligent.
Yeah, that's right. And we generally don't use the last word. We just say res ipsa in the biz. Because nobody likes to pronounce that last word anyway.
So that's how you know who the rookies are.
Yeah.
When they say the full thing, they say, that guy's a rookie. He doesn't know the shortcuts. I know that law on a first name basis.
Yeah. Your Honor, under the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, blah, 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 blah. You say, Judge, res ipsa applies here. You know.
Well, if you're a really veteran lawyer, you just say race.
That just means thing.
Well, Judge, race applies here. What?
Well, Judge, that literally translates into, well, Judge, thing applies here.
You could be totally misunderstood if you did that.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know. My Latin's not great. That could be, ipsa might be thing. I don't know.
Ipsa?
Yeah.
Living la vida loca. That's if you threw that on the judge and let him figure that out.
Yeah. My
Latin. Judge, living la vida loca applies here.
My Latin teacher would probably be pretty upset at me for not knowing that, but oh well. I don't think she listens to my podcast. So.
Yeah, any good Latin teacher would not listen to our podcast.
Although I am friends with my Latin teacher's son, and actually saw him last night. So I still do have some sort of tenuous contact with my Latin teacher. So maybe she does listen to it. I don't know.
Oh, all right. Send her a link.
And the last question is strict liability. What is that?
Strict liability means that you are responsible, whether you've put a contract out for it or warranty out or whatever, that if something bad happens, something wrong happens or it breaks, you're responsible regardless whether you mention that directly or not.
Well, you kind of tiptoed around it there. That's pretty close. So strict liability is the standard of liability under which a person is legally responsible for the consequences flowing from an activity, even in the absence of fault or criminal intent on the part of the defendant. So even if there's no real fault or any intent on that, it doesn't matter because they're responsible for the consequences that flow from the damage the person sustained.
Just like Greenman, right?
Just like Greenman.
There, I've cited Greenman now.
You did?
Race ipsa Greenman. See, now the judge knows that was my shorthand. That's my lawyer shorthand, and now he knows everything that I have to offer.
Yeah, if you really want to clean that up, you'd probably just say, Judge, race ipsa, comma, Greenman, comma, et al, comma. And they'd be like, okay.
And anything else you want to throw in there? What's that term that you gave me last week? Wasn't that it?
What's that?
The term for anything else I didn't cover or you want to throw in there?
Oh, well, that's usually whenever you file a motion or you're asking for anything from the court and you say yeah. any other relief the court deems reasonable and proper.
Yeah, I'd throw that in there too, along with those other things you said.
Yeah.
Just in case I missed something with my shorthand.
Yeah, it's like, well, Judge, in humbly, if I'm an idiot and forgot to ask for something, but you think I should get it, I'll take it.
Or even if you don't think I should get it, but my client should because he's got me for a lawyer.
The good old-fashioned catch-all.
Yeah, that's right. So. Well, it feels good to know that we're the leaders in the world in something, and we're the leaders in the world in product liability cases.
Yeah, I don't know if that's because we have the most stuff that breaks or because we're really concerned about protecting people, but it's definitely one or the other. Or maybe
both. Or we're just extremely litigious.
Well, say what you want. It's job security.
Hey, would all these like talcum powder lawsuits and all that, would that come under product liability too?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that's probably the theory.
That it caused this problem even though it was unforeseen or that it's not like they inadvertently put some kind of chemical in there they didn't mean to or something like that?
Yeah, because, I mean, is a person who buys talcum powder going to do all the testing to find out if it's a carcinogenic-type substance? No, I mean, that's obviously got to be something that falls to the industry because your average consumer can't do that.
Well, I think one of the other offshoots, too, of the product liability that I read, if I'm remembering this correctly, is that the discovery portion of it is extremely broad and aggressive, that once you file that you get, like, all of the manufacturers like emails and any kind of information related to it to be able to go through and try to find that smoking gun that identifies that the car manufacturers like the Pinto case. Mm-hmm. They found in their own documents where they were acknowledging they had problems with the Pinto before they started burning. Well, after they started burning everybody up.
Right.
And then the talcum powder, the same type thing we may have a problem with it and stuff. Whereas normal discovery, the person that you're getting the information from kind of gets to pick and choose what they're going to give you. Well, but with product liability, it really broadens it, and it makes it almost immediate. It's not like you have a big time frame to produce it. You've got to start doing it right away.
Yeah, but I mean, also, discovery is supposed to be very general to begin with. If it's possible, it can lead to discoverable information as the standard. So it's supposed to be pretty broad to begin with. But yeah, I think it, even in situations like that, it is much, much brighter in a products liability type case. So.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I read, that the discoveries was much more aggressive in these type of cases, because you're usually relying on finding something from that person to make your case, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, that happens sometimes, but you should probably have your case figured out before you have to go through discovery for the most part.
Well, it's hard to have your case and discover it, too.
It's a good legal quote to end on. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is vaccines. One of the things that I took for granted as we continue to struggle in this coronavirus crippled world is that when a vaccine came along, we would all be clamoring to get it. I thought, yeah, I want to see all those anti-vaxxers saying no. Not me, I'm not going to let them poison me. Surely this will even change their mind, right? Apparently not. In a recent poll, only about a third said they would get it. Another third said they were still deciding, and another third said no way in hell would they get it. That is hard for me to believe. I can't wait for it. If given the chance, I would have volunteered to participate in the trials that are currently underway. I can't wait to get vaccinated. I'm going to run out and lick every doorknob I see just because I can. No, actually I won't, because that's gross. But it will feel like an enormous dark cloud will be lifted from over our heads. We won't need to wear masks, we can start going to events, and even go out to eat or to bars. I mean, I know there are people doing that right now anyway, but they are inconsiderate idiots. Like the 250,000 bikers that spread it to each other in that biker fest a couple of weeks ago. Who didn't see that coming, besides those 250,000 idiots? I mean, I know they all didn't catch it, but it was still a large increase of cases. I got a notice to schedule my flu shot for the year for quicker service at my local pharmacy. The flu? The flu? I fought in the general direction of the flu. I didn't used to worry about the flu, and then as I got older, I decided I should get my flu shot. Besides, it's free, and I like free. But now, we've had COVID-19, and that is some badass stuff. You think the flu worries me? I'll go roll in a pile of flu. I don't care about the flu. I just don't want to get the coronavirus. That's the shot I want to get. If all of these people are still against getting vaccines for the coronavirus when it comes out, give it to me. I'll take all of the extra ones and I'll be super immune. I'll be able to eat coronavirus and it won't hurt me. But here's the good thing. If you get the vaccine, you help yourself and not someone else. Unlike the mask, where it seems every other human is not concerned with being human and wearing a mask because it only helps others and not themselves, but the vaccine protects you, so I'm getting mine. And if you don't want to, well, that's too bad for you. Now, I am helping you out by getting mine because you can't get it from me. But when two of you meatheads get together and one of you gives it to the other, you got no one to blame but yourself. So good luck to all you anti-vaxxers. It was nice knowing you. I'm getting mine as soon as possible, and then I'll be able to read on your tombstone where it says, "Whoops, maybe I should have listened to that dumbass Tommy." This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.